Welcome to Hazard Class, the podcast created for and about you, the emergency responder.
Welcome to the show. I'm Mark Norman.
I'm Dave Godin.
And I'm Jesse Taylor.
And I'm Chris Weber, and this is Hazard Class, the show where, if you're not careful, you just might learn something.
So who invited this guy?
Chris Weber. Welcome, Chris.
Hey. Thanks, guys.
Chris Weber, welcome to the show. We're going to introduce you properly in just a minute. But Chris, first of all, is going to be our in-house subject matter expert on the topic of this week. But also recently joined 908 Devices as a member of FAST, right, JT?
Yeah, he was one of our instructors. You probably know him from the instructor interviews as well as some of the trainings he's done. And here he is, a field application science team.
Yeah. Excited to be here.
Great to have you, Chris. Thanks for coming aboard. And I will say, this is your audition for Hazard Class. So as an instructor in the cadre, you might be good enough for JT's instructor cadre, but we'll have to see. No,
shots,
we're gonna have some fun.
Fired.
Yeah, I've known Chris a long time, and great to have him part of the team. And on this show this week, we are sort of finalizing our three-part series on technologies of advanced meters. And as we discussed in another show, these are the category A technologies, the structural techniques. We talked about infrared spectroscopy. And then the last one, we talked about Raman with Dr. Chris Brown. And this show, we're wrapping up with mass spectrometry. We're going to talk about GC mass spec as well as it relates to that. And also ion mobility, IMS. I know, Chris, you have a lot of experience with that. And Dave, a key point here is we're shifting our focus sort of from bulk identification to trace, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of a key thing.
Absolutely. GCMS is one of those technologies that can go down to the incredibly sensitive levels. It's really just a matter of how that sample is introduced and how that system is designed.
Yeah,
and
so,
it's awesome for mixtures.
Oh, absolutely. GC mass spec. So we're going to talk mixtures and how it applies to mass spec only and GC mass spec and all that great stuff. You're going to learn a ton in this show. But I want to give Chris a couple of minutes here to sort of introduce himself to the listeners. We did that on our first show, but you're new to the team. So, Chris, tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Oh, I've got a little bit of an eclectic background. Start off in the volunteer fire service when I was 18, way out on the East Coast in Virginia, and moved up to Michigan for grad school. Actually, did some graduate work. I have a PhD in biochemistry, did some X-ray crystallography, figuring out what proteins look like down to the molecular level, as it were. And along the way, continued on in the fire service and joined the county hazmat team just west of Detroit as a hazmat tech, became the training officer there, and then left there a little over 10 years ago when I was deputy director to move to Longmont, Colorado, mainly for the lifestyle and the over 300 days of sunshine a year, not to mention the skiing and the hiking. Yeah.
Nice.
It is. It's been a lot of fun out here, I have to say that. And then joined the hazmat team in the county here. And I was on that team for quite a number of years. So been involved in the emergency services. And along the way, left the biomedical research early 2000s when Michigan State Police asked me to do some training and really got into it and started training for lots of different companies, including Ahura Scientific, which has a lot of history with folks here.
A lot of folks here. Yep.
Smith's Detection and lots of other companies as well. So, and I'm real excited now to be back with two of the roots, the Ahura roots and the Smith Smith's roots through Mark. So
we worked together at Smith Detection back in the day. And of course, Chris, you are the self-proclaimed Dr. Hazmat. So you have your own training business. And I know a lot of listeners might have even been to some of your classes, and you do some fantastic stuff with Rick Dufek, tactical chemistry and things like that.
Yep. Oh, thanks.
And you're a huge proponent of, you know, using all the tools that you have at your disposal and understanding how they work together. And then that's basically what we discuss on this show.
Yeah, absolutely. That toolbox is so critical, being able to get all of those different answers, put them together to get that complete picture of what's going on at an incident. Where are the dangers? What are the dangers? How can I overcome those dangers?
All right. So, Chris, welcome to the show and to the team. We're going to have a great discussion today on mass spec. But first, we got to answer the trivia question from the last show, and I posed it. So, if you recall, the question was this. We talked about Raman. We talked a lot about lasers. The question was, there is a type of a common infrared laser, that can actually cut through metal. And other stuff.
Ooh.
Remember, we had discussed on that show the difference between energy and power.
So
infrared, relatively low energy in terms of the electromagnetic spectrum. But the question was, what is the name of that laser? And the hint was, think breathing. So the answer is a carbon dioxide or CO2 laser. Yeah. And that's where the breathing comes from. So CO2 laser is a type of a gas laser. So there's lots of different types of lasers, but it emits at around 10 microns, which is around 1,000 wave numbers in that mid-infrared. But the thing is, those CO2 lasers, they can have power levels of several hundred kilowatts. So pretty powerful, versus the lasers we talked about in the Raman systems. They're like a few milliwatts. We'll have another question at the end of today's show. It will be related to the topic of today. But before we get into the show, Dave Godin, do what you always do so well and let the fine folks out there know we appreciate them.
Yeah, this show is especially for all of our emergency responders, our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, our fire and emergency services, law enforcement personnel, emergency medical technicians and responders, as well as all of our public health and safety workers who are just out there these days on the front lines, again, keeping us all safe, even in these times of extreme circumstances. Thank you for your service, and we hope that this podcast helps you perform your duties.
That's what we hope to do is to give you some information, educate you, but also give you some tips and tricks, help you do your job. So thank you, Dave, and thank you to all those brave men and women in uniform. So let's talk in general terms about mass spectrometry. Now, it's very different from the optical spectroscopy we discussed on the first two parts of this series. So IR and Raman, we're looking at the spectra that represent chemical bonds. And there we're talking about vibrating molecular bonds and how they interact with light. Chris Weber, as our subject matter expert, can you talk a bit about how a mass spectrometer, which obviously is very different, produces a spectrum and sort of what is the chemical information that is there?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And a mass spectrometer is quite a big different, right? You know, Raman, infrared, we're actually looking at individual bonds versus with mass spectrometry, we're looking at, we're actually looking at the mass of that whole molecule. So we're looking at essentially, you know, the weight, the atoms of that molecule. Mm-hmm. So we've got to get it into the vapor phase, and that could be a little tricky with our heavier molecules, because the heavier a molecule is, you know, the less volatile it is. You know, the lower that vapor pressure, the higher the boiling point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, you know, once we get it in the vapor phase, somehow we've got to create that ion, and that's where there's a number of different ways of doing that, but essentially you're slugging it with some energy and causing an electron to pop off. And, you know, we've got some traditional instruments that do that. The photoionization detector, relatively weak ionization, you know, all the way up to kind of our traditional mass spectrometers that end up using 70 EV, et cetera, type of.
Yeah, we're going to get into some of those specific techniques as we talk a little bit later. But yeah, somehow you got to make ions. Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. Yeah, and then depending on, you know, what ionization source you use, you could just ionize the parent, kind of like what a photoionization detector, a PID, does, just knocks off one electron. But we're not measuring a mass or anything with a PID, so that's where the mass spectrometer comes in. We're going to end up weighing how much that molecule, how big it is. And that's going to give us some key information on it. And that's the molecular ion or parent ion. And that gives us a lot of good information. But it's kind of one-dimensional. If all we're doing is weighing that, there's going to be a whole bunch of other molecules out there that weigh the same. So it's going to be hard to tell two similar weight materials from one another.
No, we want something more structural.
Yeah, absolutely, right? Where we, you know, knock off a portion or break apart that molecular ion. And if we've got a pretty good ionization source, more than, say, a UV bulb that a PID has, now we can start breaking apart that molecule and we can start getting fragment ions. And those are pretty characteristic because the weaker bonds are going to break easier. And, you know, that's something that's consistent among any individual molecule. And even more importantly, typically different than something else that happens to weigh the same. So now when we look at the molecular ion and the fragments or daughters, put all of that together, we got a nice 2D spectrum. And that gives us a nice fingerprint, similar to what I assume you guys talked about with the infrared and the Raman spectroscopy.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. We talked about how you get a fingerprint, a molecular fingerprint. And again, we'll talk more in the show about how this fingerprint from mass spectrometry is different. Couple of points I just want to clarify. So, Chris, when you say the mass, I like to tell people, like you look in the NIOSH pocket guide, or any reference material for a chemical, you'll have what's called the molecular weight. It's actually the molar mass, but it's the weight, right? Yep. So that's kind of what we're talking about when you say that molecular weight. Yeah. And then, as you said, those molecules, depending on what they are and how they're put together, they can break apart. So yeah, Chris, that's basically what happens. You ionize it, you weigh the ion and ions that come off, and you get this spectrum. Now, the mass spectrum, and Chris, feel free to chime in, unlike with the optical tools where you're looking at, depending on the technique, absorbance or just scattering intensity on the sort of the y-axis, and on the bottom you're seeing energy, which is like wave numbers. We talked about those units. Here you're actually looking at intensity, or the total number of ions, versus mass. And more specifically, it's actually, Chris, the mass to charge ratio, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely, right? Because we got to ionize them. That's the way we manipulate them. Every once in a while, you can knock off more than one electron and change up that charge. It's pretty rare. So usually it's straight up mass, and, you know, we tend to fall into that trap. But technically it is mass over charge.
Yeah, usually the charge is one. So we just kind of use the term mass. Yeah. And
plus
then
one, minus
I want
to...
Yeah, throw out another term, atomic mass unit. I know JT and Dave, even Chris, in our trainings, we refer to the mass range on like the MX908 mass spectrometer, any others, usually expressed in terms of AMU. We'll get into the details, but it's relative to the carbon-12 isotope as an exact mass of 12, but that's what we're talking about. So let's just simplify it and just say mass, right, Dave?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's keep this simple and move it forward. We're just talking about mass. Really, really fancy scales.
So it's all about the mass. It's all about the mass. And again, we'll talk about now the mass doesn't necessarily correlate to chemical physical properties, but we're going to discuss that a little bit later. But you're still getting some structural information. And before we move on into some details, Chris, IMS, ion mobility, we've kind of teased this. Just kind of quickly give us a taste, listeners, a taste of how is this fundamentally, you know, similar but different from mass spec in terms of what you're getting?
IMS is kind of interesting. I mean, it's been around, gosh, probably since the 50s, easy. And ionization, like you guys have been saying, is involved in that as well. But fundamentally, what we measure about that ion differs in IMS, ion mobility spectrometry. And we're really just measuring drift time. And that just means how long it takes for the ion to go from the gate, kind of where it enters the drift, down to the detector. And that's really, you know, charge affects it, shape affects it, and then how that drift tube set up affects it, along with there's a number of other, you know, chemistry that can happen before you create that ion as well. You might have heard dopants are involved in IMS, depending on how deep you are into the whole IMS. But fundamentally, we're not measuring mass. We're kind of indirectly measuring that because that's going to affect how fast that ion travels down that drift tube. But size and other or shape and other factors also play a large role. And we really do not get a direct size measurement there. So so when you look at, you know, mass spectrometry versus IMS, it really is apples and oranges. It's almost like trying to throw a photoionization detector in there. Yeah, ions are created, but all three are fundamentally different from one another.
Yeah, in an IMS, I like to go back to what's on the x-axis. It's not mass. It's basically time. Essentially. So it's more of a how fast do they travel as they go down that tube.
And so that's actually a good point, right? Like IMS you'll typically find in your more detector role, right, where it's incredibly sensitive. It's a pretty rapid analysis, so you can get your answer very quickly. And we've done a lot of work in the institution to ruggedize most of these systems over time, although there are some more benchtop applications that you'll see like at ports of entry and such. But in general, they're very good at detecting low levels of potential threat qualities, threat materials. But again, they're that category B technique, so they're going to be a little less specific than your category A. And so they benefit from some more confirmatory analysis by other technologies.
Absolutely.
We're going to get into some details on mass spec and IMS. Before that, got a little message from our marketing department. You guys ready?
Let's hear it.
Real-time threats. Real-time detection. The MX908 is a multi-mission tool utilized by elite responders, not lazy ones, elite responders, only the best, conducting chemical, explosive, priority drug, and hazmat operations around the world. Actually, not all around the world. We're not in South America yet. You know where we are? We're in Mexico.
Sí, claro, estamos en México.
Yeah, JT speaks fluent Spanish. You actually were down there doing training, and then you know where else we are? Chris Weber, we're in Germany.
Oh, yeah? Toll. Es gefällt mir.
You know where we're not? We're not in Russia.
What? Что это такое?
So maybe someday, Dave, you can go train there. Sorry, off track. But trace level threat detection and discriminating selectivity deliver real-time, actionable intelligence in seconds. For more information, visit www.908devices.com/MX908. That's 908devices.com/MX908. 08.
All right. That's All a right. real marketing message. Sounds real great for a real Love podcast. It.
Let's get into mass spec. First, as we kind of following our trend with the other shows, I want to talk about the components. Let's first talk about ionization. But first, I want to make a point about the types of techniques. And I want to say to our listeners, the students of hazard class, behave, but there's what we call soft and hard ionization techniques. All right. That's the term they use. Now, what do we mean by that? It really means how much energy is imparted into it. So, Chris, you mentioned electron impact, right?
Yeah.
That's what, 70 electron volts?
Typically? Yeah, 60, 70, depending on the exact instrument. But yeah, very powerful and really does a number on those molecular ions.
You're just hitting the crap out of those molecules. And exactly. Again, comparison to PID, right, about 10.6.
Yep.
So
yep.
That's kind of where you are. So that's a hard ionization technique. So you're hitting the molecules with a sledgehammer, let's just say.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's others. If anyone remembers the M908, which was the predecessor to the MX908, it used glow discharge. There's a few electron volts, so it's sort of comparable to a PID, but that's soft ionization. So you're not hitting the molecule as hard. In the MX908, it actually uses chemical ionization. So there's this glow discharge that actually ionizes the background atmospheric molecules. It happens at atmospheric pressure. And then it actually doesn't ionize the analyte itself. You get this charge transfer that occurs. So you imagine there's water vapor, there's nitrogen, there's other stuff. And again, it's a few electron volts. Now, here's the thing. It can form positive and negative ions simultaneously.
Right. Yeah.
Which is great because, JT, what type of ions do explosives like to form?
Oh, they love the negative ion range.
They love it. Yeah. So you want to be able to do both. So you got that. You can also use lasers to do this, not in the field systems. In the IMS systems, what it's typically, or at least historically, radioactive sources, right? Or maybe a corona.
Yeah, absolutely. Americium probably being the most common one out there. Well, yeah, nickel as well.
There's nickel 63, I think.
Yep. Nickel 63, americium 241. Makes it a little bit more difficult in the upkeep maintenance, having to do swipe tests depending on how intense that that radiation source is. So it's kind of, you know, for our end users out there, me included, I always wasn't too keen on having to do all the swipe tests on a regular basis. So.
And you're going back to things like the APD 2000 and the Sabre, of course, more recently the JCAD or the commercial. Yeah, the commercial LCD.
Yeah, that's changed up now. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They switched over to corona discharge.
Oh, that's good.
Right.
Yeah.
So we make the ions. We make them in a way, in a field device that, does what we need to do. And kind of, Chris, to your point, getting away from the radioactive sources minimizes the logistical burden of doing wipe down and all that. But once the ions are there, now we got to measure them.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about mass analysis. And just for a little bit of a history lesson, a couple different types of what we call mass analyzers, okay, in the parlance of mass spec. There's something called a magnetic sector, which is just a magnetic field. You sort of pass the ions through. That's not in the field. It's just one of those types. But then you have what's called the quadrupole. And if I'm not mistaken, that's what is used in the Hapsite systems.
Yeah.
So absolutely. It's basically, Chris, you want to describe that real quick, the quadrupole mass analyzer?
It's essentially passing the ions, through a magnetic field and, linearly as the name implies, and depending on that mass to charge ratio, we can speed up or slow down those ions and separate them out. So, depending on that field, they'll strike that detector at, different points. And
yeah, and basically you have like four rods, right? Yep. Just think of four rods.
Yep.
And the two rods apart from each other, they're set at one DC voltage, and the other two rods separate are AC. And then you sort of play with those voltages, and then you can sort of select the ions that get through. They're pretty compact and amenable to field use. And so that's another type, the linear.
Right.
Yeah. Quadrupole. There's something called the time of flight, TOF, we often say in mass spec. Again, not really. You don't see it in the field, but it's kind of comparable to the IMS, where, Chris, you mentioned it's drift time. So conceptually, it's comparable. Right. You're measuring how fast ions go through a sort of a tube, as it were.
Yeah, the great thing about the TOF mass specs is in a lab, you can make that tube, like the size of the drift tube will allow you to get better resolution. And so it's not limited by field applications.
Yeah. It's good for large size molecules as well.
Oh, yeah. So nice big tube gives you a nice big resolution, as they say. But it's a good point, Jesse, but not used in the field. Then let's talk about the ion trap. Now, that is what is in the MX908. And Chris, again, we're not going to get into, any sensitive information, but the guard ion, you've worked a ton with that. That uses a type of ion trap as well, which is really a three-dimensional quadrupole, as it were, in terms of you have a couple of electrodes, ring electrodes, and an end cap electrodes. So, Chris, you want to talk real quick about the ion trap and sort of how that works and a little bit different?
Ion trap mass spectrometers, they store those ions in the trap for a time being, which actually creates, some pretty interesting dynamics between the ions, ion chemistry, ion interactions.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a little controversial in the field. There's pros and cons to both. I personally kind of like it because you do get, dimers and potentially, depending on how you've ionized that molecule, you can get different sized ions interacting. So you actually get some pretty unique fragments.
Yeah. So what you're saying is in the trap, because it's kind of like a little cup. Right? The ions are in there. They're sort of buzzing around in these trajectories. But depending on the concentration they're in there, they can clump together and get these clusters, we call them. So that's fairly unique. And that can be, pretty helpful. You take two of the molecular ions and, let's say the molecular ion's 200 and you get a peak at 400. Okay, well, that's two of the molecular. And then that gives you information that's very useful.
Yeah.
And the ability for us to tell those weights apart depends in part upon resolution, which leads us to vacuum.
Dave brought up vacuum requirements and getting those ions to be isolated from all the other molecules in the air, essential.
Yeah.
And so in a lab, we can have a big turbo pump and get a very low vacuum. On a field detector, less size and weight allows us to have a little more difficulty in trying to figure out how to make that vacuum. So that is an essential requirement. Interesting point about vacuum. We measure in ATMs or the TOR is a one ATM. One ATM is 760 TOR, normal units for vacuum, not the SI
unit. ATM being an atmosphere,
right?
ATM is an atmosphere. Yeah. Not the SI unit, which is a Pascal. You use the term TOR a lot, right, Jesse? That's what you brought up. That's what we talked about. Yeah.
And for folks, for our hazmat folks out there, a TOR is just a millimeter of mercury.
What the hell does TOR mean, Jesse? I think you had a little interesting tidbit on that.
Oh, yeah. It's named after the Italian physicist, mathematician, Evangelista Torricelli, who actually is the first one credited with creating a sustained vacuum and discovering the principle of the barometer back in the 1600s.
Right. And so your laboratory mass specs, those are under what we like to call a very high vacuum, where they're nearly at outer space pressures, so to speak, right? And some of our fielded systems will be operating under closer to atmospheric pressure. Certainly the MX908 is an atmospheric pressure or a high pressure mass spec. And so they're operating closer to that that level.
So an atmosphere is 760 TOR. Those lab systems and the systems that Dave's referring to, like 0.00001 tor around that, like 10 to the minus six. The HPMS and the MX9 is around one tor. So, Chris, I know you've used fielded GC mass spec systems. Dave, you've used one in theater. We've all used the MX908. Chris, just kind of talk quickly about the relative sort of startup and ready times, like ready to go for those, and sort of why that is, real quick.
Yeah, those can be a little bit longer. One is that requirement for getting a vacuum. But then also the GCMS systems especially, so on the vacuum side, you've got the pump down time, which obviously takes a little bit of time to just to get to those high vacuum level. It's not a linear. It really takes longer as you get to the higher vacuum. And, you know, theoretically, you can't even get to a pure vacuum anyway. But then you've also got some other components on the GCMS side where tuning the instrument at the beginning takes a little bit of time. Between the gas chromatograph and the mass spectrometer, there's a number of different parameters that need to be typically calibrated at the start of a run. Because again, things are exquisitely sensitive in a GCMS. And those masses are very critical because that high vacuum does allow you to get better resolution, but that also requires precision. And again, in a lab, on a bench, instruments tend to be pretty stable.
Yeah.
But as we start transporting them around on trucks, driving lights and siren, all of those slight vibrations or big vibrations, if you hit a pothole, are going to have an effect on the settings of the device. So you put together, you know, just the mechanical difficulties of getting a high vacuum, and then the precision requirements and the calibration and tuning requirements, as it's often called.
And
you know, so anywhere might take you from 10-15 minutes.
Easy. That's fine, right? So typically we find our mass specs not necessarily brought into the hot or warm zone, right? We typically bring samples to it or to a slightly rearward, you know, forward field lab is typically the way that I see them implemented. Some advanced hazmat teams will have like a truck where they'll be their mass spec or their analytical equipments are mounted. And that's how they really deal with some of these complicated scenes. Because for all of that, a mass spec, right, is a really, it's one of those gold standard devices. It gives you a ton of information. And part of one of the things it excels at and where you really need to bring a mass spec to bear is these really complex mixtures. And the reason a mass spec does that, fun fact, isn't necessarily because it's a mass spec. It's because of this pairing that we often find it in with that GC.
So let's talk about sample prep, as it were, kind of quickly. We mentioned getting things in the vapor phase. And if things are very non-volatile, high boiling point, all systems will have some sort of thermal desorption. But the GC, Dave, to your point, is kind of like the sample prep, right? It's that, I think of it like a racetrack to allow a mixture of molecules to separate. And then what happens after that day?
Yeah. So it's, as you said, it's a chemical racetrack. So the components of a mixture will separate out based off of some chemical interactions or just straight retention time in that that column. And so they'll hit the mass spec and then they'll be ionized as constituent components, rather than all at once as part of a larger mixture. And that allows the GCMS in particular to handle complex mixtures and analyze them as more discrete data points without additional sample prep.
Yeah, we talked about startup time. And the GC, to Dave's point, is a great way of separating mixtures. But what are now the implications for analysis time when it comes to that, Chris?
Yeah. Yeah, the analysis obviously takes a little bit longer to separate the materials. On top of that, we're going to need a carrier gas. We've got to have something pushing our vapors, typically gases as well, depending on which mass spec, which GCMS you have. But we'll just say vapors for now. That pushes them down essentially a hollow tube. It's a little bit more complicated than that because that tube's coated. And, and there is some chemical interaction, physical interaction occurring. But we're essentially pushing our molecules down because they haven't been ionized yet. They're still the chemicals themselves. They're not charged. Otherwise, they'd stick to everything. And we push them down that tube. And now kind of here's the rub. You can have a really short tube, but it's not going to really do a very good job in separating out the materials because
no one wants a short tube. Yeah,
exactly. Short
size matters.
But yeah, so the longer your chromatograph is, the longer that tube is, the better separation you're going to get and the better resolution you're going to get. So that's where you can see everything from the Guardian had about a 3-minute runtime all the way up to a half hour, depending on, you know, some lab systems, 15 to 20 minutes in the field. And again, you know, that adds quite a bit of time, especially when we start talking about PIDs and HPMS, air monitors, where we're talking seconds to get an answer.
Yeah. Yeah, and Chris talked about time,
right?
But we got to think about how does it fit into tactical decision making, and what are you trying to do when, and what information do you need when, Dave?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So GC mass spec, again, is that powerful tool, but you really want to make sure that you're leveraging it against the appropriate samples. And that's why I typically find it in my operational scheme in slightly, you know, after incident or during incident. It benefits from having something downrange, screening for high priority, high likelihood samples, so that you can make a quick tactical decision about what sample is relevant that needs to be collected and can be brought to that GCMS to get, you know, that best possible answer. So it's also worth noting that a GC is its own technology. It's a category B technology onto itself. Correct. And so you're adding that additional data point of retention time into your identification. So all chemicals will have a unique retention time per column, per system, and you can compare that as an additional point. So not only should the mass spec line up, but that retention time should line up as well. And that means it can be its own orthogonal technique.
Yeah, absolutely. And continuing on with my dimensions, that makes, in my mind, GCMS a three-dimensional technique. I've got the two dimensions of mass spectrometry, and I've got the one dimension of chromatography.
Welcome to the third dimension.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Cool. All right, so the MX908 doesn't use a GC column, but we retain we obtain some separation through our thermal desorption process for our trace samples in particular. So we have a light heating ramp, and that lightly separates out compounds based off of their, you know, their melting points and their vaporization points. And that allows us to still get some separation into the mass spectrometer, but still allow us to also do that analysis in near real time, so seconds as opposed to minutes. And that's one of the like advantages of bringing it tactically instead of, you know, reserving it in the rear.
Yeah, you do get some amount of temporal separation based on their boiling points and how they come off. So it's a nice little added advantage, and the algorithms account for that. So I want to get into spectral interpretation implications real quick. We talked about IR and Raman. Now here we have the mass spectrum. We talked about you get the peaks that are associated with masses, specifically mass to charge, but masses of the molecular ion and or the fragment ions. Here's the thing, Dave Godin, and I know you're a huge fan of reachback, but unlike infrared Raman, where you can look at a chemical peak, and Chris, I know you've done a lot of this too, optical spectroscopy reachback, you can't say, oh, it's a carbonyl, so it could have this chemical property. Mass doesn't tell you that. And I know, JT, you use an example in the training, like hexamine and trimethyl phosphate.
Right.
You know, they weigh the same, but
same
their
molecular weight.
Very different. Yeah. So Dave Godin, could you just talk quickly to, okay, what are the expectations one should expect in terms of reach back from a mass spectrum sent to a scientist?
Right. So mass spectrum, that molecular ion that we talk about, which is really prominent in your soft ionization techniques, is really essential for unknown material analysis. So if you have no idea what it is, a molecular ion is very helpful in confirming or denying indications from the field. So if you have a presumptive ID, a quick look at the molecular ion can tell you absolutely not, or yep, that's included in that weight, right? Yeah. Like, so a molecular ion can be very informative when you're just trying to confirm positive or presumptive identifications in the field via reach back. And so that's why for a mass spectrum in particular, any other additional information from other technologies can be very helpful in interpreting mass spectrum and confirming and denying the results of an unknown analysis.
Yeah, and so it basically comes down to you can't really infer chemical information in terms of properties, but chemical information in terms of structure. And certainly can say, like if someone says, hey, we suspect fentanyl is present, and you can look at it and say, oh, no, the ion for fentanyl is not there, at least not in the data. So within the sensitivity of the device, it's not suggestive of that, things like that. Let's kind of bring this home and talk about some of the things. So
takeaway messages.
What are the take home messages for the listeners of Hazard Glass on this episode?
So overall, in general, this episode is about mass spec, and this is one of the other great technologies for the toolbox, if it's not in there already. And even if you do have mass spec, we've talked about several different ways of ionization and detection. And so even multiple mass specs can be useful because having different detectors and different sampling capabilities definitely is functional for field applications.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. With or without GC. Yeah.
So we're going to wrap up here. Thank you, Chris, for your input. It's been great. We do have a trivia question to wrap up the show. And JT, I think you have the one today, right? All right. Yes, you ready for that, my friend? Here we go.
Absolutely. All right. I talked about the Tor being named after Evangelista Torricelli. Well, we have another trivia about units named after important contributors or scientists in this field. The AMU is a unit used to describe the mass axis on a mass spectrometer. And just like the Tor was named after a scientist, there's another term that we use in mass spec, which is equal to the AMU. What is that term? Hint, it's a person's name. Give us the full name of that person and you'll get to the top of the prize list. We will do a random selection of all the correct answers to award the prize. And let's see, what do we have in the prize closet today, Mark?
What do we got in the prize closet today? This is relevant to what we're doing. This is, get this, a 908 device's bathroom scale.
Ooh, right. Yeah. The mass spec is just a fancy scale.
Fancy scale, but get this. It's not just that. It's digital, but it's got, just like the alarm clock, Alyssa's voice.
Nice.
Telling you, hey, nice job. Yeah, nice job today. Or, hey, maybe have a salad for dinner.
So in addition to answers, you can contact us with comments, show ideas, questions. We'd love to hear from you. How was this useful to you? Did you use it on the job? And what kind of stuff can we bring up to give you some more insight into the applications for field use of technology? So hazardclass@908devices.com, hazardclass@908devices.com.
Absolutely. And so with that, we're going to wrap up this three-part series on these fielded category A technologies. And I want to thank Chris Weber for joining the team. Welcome. Thanks welcome for all your FAST. Input. Welcome
to FAST. Be here.
Yeah. Thank you folks for listening. And I'll just say, tune in next time for another episode of Hazard Glass, the show where if you're not careful, you just might learn something.
Well, that's it. Past the class dismissed.